The Jewish tradition has a Day of Atonement, and right then it sounded like a great idea to me. Except that a single day might not be enough in my case. I might need something like a year of atonement. I know that I did not kill Hal myself, or Kodiak Black, or Gunnar Magnusson, or the Morrigan, or innumerable others. But that's not how guilt works on the mind. It points out a string of cause and effect to saddle you with responsibility that isn't yours. And then it hops into that saddle, rakes you with spurs, and rides you until you collapse. Unless you can find some redemption along the way. Owen hasn't said anything, but I'm sure he's feeling the bite of guilt about Fand and Mononym McLear. I shared with him what Makira told me, in hopes it would help him on his own journey. "Owen, listen, I know where Fand is," I said. An odd way to begin a conversation at sunrise, but my Ark Druid has never cared for niceties. She's holed up at the Morrigan's Fen with Mononym. They're going to be tough to peel out of there, but I imagine the sooner you move against them, the easier it'll be.
How do you know that?
I talked with a seer, who's quite a sight better than you or me. She told me.
Well, it fits. I could see that they were in a swamp, and the Morrigan's Fen certainly qualifies. Damn good hiding place. I never would have thought to look there. Thank you, lad.
I caught a couple of pensive expressions on Granuaile's face last night, which she claimed represented nothing when I asked. I didn't know if she was wrestling with guilt ferrets of her own, but speculated that her renewed fervor to battle the slow poisoning of the earth might be her own method of atonement. Few things shape our lives so strongly as guilt. Or perhaps she was worried about Loki, with good cause. I'd already known that Loki had found her at our cabin in Colorado, but over last night's campfire, she told Owen and me for the first time the details of what had happened there. Inside the fire ward we'd placed around our cabin, she had beaten him up, put a tomahawk in his back, and pronounced that he was now living under the death sentence of a druid. There was no doubt that the reverse was also true. He would kill her on sight if he could. And the same was probably true for us. I'm sure he had something to do with her worry. When she first asked to become my apprentice, I did all I could to warn her. Magic users sometimes lived very long lives, but they very often died violent deaths. And I showed her that stinking carnage at Tony Cabin, had her look upon the chewed-up head of Emily, the corrupt sister. All of which was more powerful than simply telling her, and she still chose to be a druid. But even being shown rather than told about violence is nothing compared to experiencing it yourself. And I think she was changed by her encounter with Loki in India. How could she not be? I hope that striking back at him, coupled with the protection of her divination cloak, gave her a measure of therapeutic satisfaction. But the insouciance she possessed when she was first bound and flush with the wonder of Gaia, that might have been crushed like her bones, and she couldn't bind those feelings together again. "Before we get into this today," I said to her, "we should probably think of where to keep the hounds safe. This place is nice, but there isn't much in the way of fresh water or game. Pretty much a desert up on top of those cliffs."
"I know a good place," she said. "Foothills of the Andes. Mild temperatures right now. Nice freshwater lake. Fat, slow llamas nearby if they get hungry."
"We should feed them first, but yes, that sounds good." When we asked the hounds what they wanted to eat, Oberon had an immediate answer.
"Poutine!"
We got them both to Toronto, where it was just past midnight, but Boutini's House of Poutine on Queen Street West was open late, and we scored some huge containers of the good stuff. Then we took them to the spot in Ecuador that Granuaile knew about. Even though they'd slept all night in Angola, they assured us that they would have no trouble sleeping some more after the glories of a full belly. The bitter cold of Rome contrasted starkly with the warmth of the southern hemisphere, and Owen noted aloud he was thankful for his coat.
"Me tits would be all in an uproar if I didn't have it," he said.
We all filled up our reservoirs of energy before we left the Villa Borghese. Rome was one of the oldest and most continuously paved cities in the world, Even beneath the pavement, there's more pavement. A city built on centuries of older cities. We wouldn't have endless energy to spend against the vampires should it come to a fight. Our best hope was to break through their wards and take them out before nightfall.
"'Tis a dead, frigid hellscape for a druid, and that's no lie,"
Owen commented as soon as he hit the city proper and the touch of Gaia was lost.
"It's really unusual, though, for it to be this cold here," I said. It was mid-morning, and the city was covered by the sort of low, dark clouds one would expect to boil out of Mordor.
"Looks like it might snow. And that happens maybe once every 20 years. I bet you the Romans will freak out and stay at home."
"Good," Granuaile said. "The fewer people we have to worry about, the better."
Tourist traffic in the Piazza di Spagna was almost nil. Even the vendors selling selfie sticks and other nonsense had written the day off and stayed home. We told the rabbi to meet us in Babington's, a decision that at least kept us cozy while we waited. He in turn spread the word to the other hammers, and we saw them begin to trickle in after noon. We didn't hail them and invite them to pull up a table, but rather let them find each other and wait for Rabbi Yosef. I was worried that some of them might possess the extremist views that Yosef had in his youth, and I'd rather wait for him to arrive before introducing ourselves to devout monotheists as pagans, adept in the practice of magic. Rabbi Yosef arrived last, in the mid-afternoon, since he had the farthest to travel. He first greeted his comrades with hugs and a wide smile. Then he spied us in the far corner and waved us over. He introduced us as the fine individuals who allowed the hammers to do such wonderful work in the Western Hemisphere recently. And now, Lord willing, we would help strike another mighty blow against the oldest of evil's minions on Earth. We got polite nods, but no names from the rest of the hammers. They were not anxious to make our acquaintance. We were to be useful creatures rather than friends.
"Shall we look at our target, then?" I asked.
We settled our bills and bundled up against the chill outside. A few hardy tourists, determined to get their money's worth for their air tickets to Rome, tried to look cheerful in the gloom. The surface of Bernini's fountain, I noticed, had a thin coating of ice at the edges. Once in front of the buildings in question, Rabbi Yosef Bialik squinted at the wards and muttered in Hebrew to his companions. They nodded and exchanged some words, and then he addressed us.
"You are right. These are interlocking trees of the Hermetic Kabbalah, but they are collapsible triggers."
"What do you mean?"
"Upon any tree being dispelled with cold iron or anything else, the rest are able to isolate themselves and remain intact. You cannot dispel the entire ward, in other words, only the portion of it you walk through with your cold iron. The remaining trees are supposed to know the absence of any around them and trigger a response."
"What response?" Ronuel asked.
"That I do not know. It could be an attack, or it could merely be an alarm, letting the casters know that the ward has been broken."
"Normal folks pass in and out without consequence, then," I said. "Clever."
"I'm normal folks," Owen said. "No cold iron on me."
"They will, however, like us, be able to detect the use of magic nearby," Yosef said. "If you were to use any magic at all, they would know it."
"Fair enough. I should be able to take a look inside, though, to scout. Or any of you lot could do it."
"You go," I said. "But keep your right hand in your pocket so no one spots your tattoos." Owen scanned the three buildings and chose the yellow cream one on the right, with Dolce & Gabbana on the bottom floors.
"I like that it has a grand door," he said, explaining his choice.
He walked through the ward without trouble, disappeared into the building, and returned not 5 minutes later.
"There's a hallway that goes back a ways. No place to hide. Elevator and stairs at the back, with a man there asking if I was a resident. Both the elevator and the stairs are feckin' narrow, and I wouldn't want to go up either one. Anyone at the top would have one hell of an advantage."
"What was the man like?"
Granuaile asked.
Big bastard. Had one of those modern suits and a curly thing coming out of his ear. Clearly security. But there was someone else too. Not a guard, exactly. And he said nothing, but he looked at me closely. He was sitting on the stairs, had these loose white clothes on him, and an orange sash with symbols sewn on it in gold. And the weirdest hair I've ever feckin' seen.
How so?
Shaved on the top and above the ears, except for a greasy strip all the way around, like a hairy ring.
A tonsure? I asked.
If I knew what a tonsure was, maybe I could feckin' answer ye.
So we have bodyguards and spooky cultist types, Granuaile said. Any other wards inside, Owen?
I'm sure there's plenty more upstairs, but I didn't get there. Didn't want to start a fight without knowing the odds.
I turned to the rabbi. If you have kinetic wards, I'd start with that. If they're expecting me, then they might come out with guns blazing, or they'll use something else mundane that cold iron can't dispel.
Of course, in a cloak of indifference. Innocent people will not care about what we're doing, not that there are many people out here on a day like this.
All right, we're going to withdraw out of sight, and then we'll swoop in if needed. The rabbi had no problem with this, and immediately resumed his conversation in Hebrew with the other hammers of God. Owen, however, had an objection.
Why are we hiding? Let's kick some horses already and go home.
We need to draw them out first, I said. The hammers can ward themselves on the dead land, and their ward moves with them. We can't do either, and we also can't afford the energy. If we stay in the open when this begins, the most likely result is we'll get shot. If we charge in there, the likelihood of getting shot is even higher. That guy with the crinkly thing in his ear probably had a gun underneath his jacket, and there are, without doubt, many more men like him upstairs. You taught me yourself, Owen. Never give the enemy what he wants. They want druids to walk into that trap, so we'll give them kabbalists instead. Owen bared his teeth and growled in frustration. He hated it when I was right. With a little bravado and a little luck, we ascended to the rooftop room in Babington's with a view of the piazza. It was almost like a picnic pavilion, with a low wall, wide-open windows, and fantastic views. Down to our left and proceeding up behind us, the Spanish steps rose to the church at the top. The piazza in front of us showed the 10 hammers of God aligning themselves in a tree of life formation, with Rabbi Yosef at the top, facing the green door near the entrance to Dolce & Gabbana.
You're in for a show, I said to Granuaile and Owen. You've never seen this kind of magic before. Those beards are going to throw down at some point.
What? They're actual beards? Granuaile said. You'll see. The hammers of God began to chant and move in ritualistic sequence. We didn't see all of it very well since we were above and behind them to the left, but we had an excellent view of the three warded buildings. I was watching them more than the kabbalists to see what sort of reaction they provoked. Part of me wanted to watch in the magical spectrum, but I didn't want to waste the energy. Within a minute of the hammers chanting, a couple of windows in the buildings flew open, and pale, white-clad men with tonsures leaned out to lay eyes on the kabbalists. They watched for a moment and withdrew, closing the shutters behind them. Okay, they're aware of the hammers. Response should come soon. Two men appeared on the rooftop garden of the terracotta building and pointed guns down at the hammers of God. They had large, bulky silencers, or mufflers, or whatever, screwed onto the end of the barrels. I'm not a munitions expert. They popped off a few rounds, which ricocheted off the hammer's kinetic ward, taking out a window to the north in one case, but otherwise embedding themselves in the ancient brick and plaster of the building surrounding the piazza. The kabbalists continued whatever they were doing, and remarkably, so did the sparse dozen or so tourists in the piazza, who gave no sign that they had heard gunfire. The would-be assassins looked at each other and shrugged. Then one held a finger to his earpiece and spoke, obviously reporting to someone via Bluetooth that guns weren't going to work. They disappeared after a moment. Okay, we're going to get a different sort of attack next, I said. That's when it began to snow in Rome. Big, fat snowflakes eager to blanket the eternal city and paralyze it. Tonsured men of assorted backgrounds, dressed in the billowy white clothing Owen had described, with an orange sash crossing from their right shoulders to their left hips, streamed out of the three buildings. They were heading for a spot opposite the Hammers of God, presumably to form their own tree of life. Seeing this, the Hammers of God formation flattened into two lines, staggered so that the line in back could see between the shoulders of the front line. And then in sync they drew silver knives out of their coats and threw them at a single target. Some missed, but most didn't. The targeted man went down with seven knives buried in his torso and one in his throat.
"Holy shite!" Owen said. "Why did they go after that one?"
"Align yourself with the forces of hell, and you're fair game in their eyes," I said.
"No, I mean, why that one particular man?"
I shrugged. Random target of opportunity. It was smart, because they disrupted their formation before it got started. The Hammers didn't want them to get their own kinetic ward, or anything else going. They need 10 dudes to do anything major.
"Well, I think they have 10 anyway," Granuel said. "Another one just appeared. Yep, that's 10. They might have more waiting."
Ah, damn. The Hammers didn't have additional guys in reserve. If one or more of them went down, they could maintain what they'd already cast, but not do anything in addition. Their strength in formation was impressive, but their weakness was needing to maintain that formation. Their cloak of indifference, or whatever they were using to distract passers-by, worked astoundingly well. A woman in heels clicked across the piazza, right by the body of the dead cobblest, who was an obvious murder victim and could not be mistaken for a sleeping vagrant, and walked into Dolce & Gabbana as if she'd seen nothing amiss. I wondered what its range was, because while Granuel and I had the protection of cold iron, Owen did not, and he had clearly seen that man sprout steel in his body and go down. The hermetic cobblists began their own chanting and synchronized moves, but the Hammers of God wanted to disrupt them before they completed anything. So Rabbi Yosef Bialik's beard got unleashed like some hairy nightmare elder god, puffing and expanding, and then twisting into thick tentacles, three on either side of his chin. They began to stretch out for the point man of the other formation, and Granuel gasped, while Owen pointed a shaky finger at him.
"What kind of extra special batshite is that right there? God spillo, Sheehan, if Briat was here, I'd tell her to kill it with fire."
"Told you."
"I'm gonna have nightmares."
He pawed at his face.
"I need to shave."
The hermetic cobblist had a response to the hairy cables coming his way. His tonsure came alive in much the same way, and a halo of tentacles formed around his skull before rushing to meet the rabbis.
"Oh, yuck!"
Granuel said. The two sets of hairy ropes met in the middle, struggled to get past each other, failed, then entwined and tore at the enemy in an attempt to pull the other out of formation.
"Are you kidding? This is awesome," I said. "Since I've become a druid, I've seen some pretty weird shit, Atticus," Granuel said.
"But Beardy Baggins there squaring off against Squidhead McGee in the snow might be the weirdest."
"Hold up now. Who's that lad coming out of the building on the left?"
Owen pointed to a slim, pale figure wearing sunglasses and a bespoke Italian suit. I recognized him from Berlin. He was one of the gang that got away. That's a vampire.
"How? It's not night yet," Granuel said.
"Might as well be. No sun's getting through that cloud cover, except the weakest kind."
"Easy way to find out," Owen said,
and he began to roll out the words for unbinding. Meanwhile, the vampire moved briskly, not running, just a late-for-a-meeting walk, to position himself behind the rearmost Hammer of God. He was moving too slowly to trigger the kinetic ward, and so he encountered no difficulty. He reached over the shoulder with one hand to grab the Hammer's bearded chin, placed the other on top of the head, and twisted savagely, snapping his neck. The Hammer's body went slack, and he tumbled to the cobblestones. Just as the rest of the hammers were becoming aware that their formation had been disrupted, and the vampire was moving to take out yet another of them, Owen completed his unbinding, and the contents of that fine Italian suit popped like a swollen tick, before collapsing into a dark red puddle on the piazza. This caused one of the boys in white to cry out in Italian,
"A druid is here!"
A window in the terracotta building flew open and a voice boomed,
"Do not let him escape!"
More windows flew open, probably half of the total available flats, and vampires leapt out of them, regardless of how high off the ground they were. This was far more than the 11 who'd escaped in Berlin. I honestly could not count them all because they kept coming. They began to fan out around the plaza to find me, and using camouflage wouldn't matter. They'd locate me via smell, because my blood, and presumably Owen's, were 2,000-year-old vintages.
Shit. Hey, wait. They think there's only one of us. I'll be the bait down there on the steps and let them come after me. You guys stay here and pick off all you can.
Their protests followed after me as I dashed down the stairs.
If ye cock this up, you'll be dead,
Owen pointed out helpfully. When I plowed through the front door, the first thing I did was slip on the icy steps and fall on my ass. An inauspicious beginning to battle. But I got up and noticed that the Hammers of God and their tonsured opponents had fallen to hand-to-hand, or rather to beards versus scalp squids. Ugh. Both formations were broken up now, and it was a brutal, hairy melee that I might have enjoyed watching under other circumstances. But there were many speedy vampires spreading out over the piazza, and I needed to get myself in position to lure them, hoping that Theophilus himself would come out to play eventually. Beginning to draw on the reserves of my bear charm, I increased my speed and drew out my stake, keeping Fragoras sheathed. Then I chose a vamp as I ran over to the bottom of the Spanish steps and kept my eyes on him as I mouthed the words of unbinding. He was circling around toward the Keats Shelley house on the other side of the steps from Babington's, and just as I completed the unbinding, he realized that I wasn't admiring Bernini's fountain like a tourist. His mouth formed a tiny, oh, of surprise, and then he turned into mobile slush.
He's there, at the steps!
That same stentorian voice called from the terracotta building. The vampires began to converge from all sides. Some had moved fast enough to run to the top of the steps and cut off escape to the road that snaked beneath the Trinità dei Monti church. Not that I wished to escape. I scooted over to the large block pillar of marble at one end of the steps and put myself on the other side of it, facing the stairs in case they decided to direct sniper fire my direction from those buildings. Unlike the hammers, I had no kinetic ward. I'd handle the vampires coming from above and behind Babington's, and trust Granuel and Owen to take care of threats coming at me from the piazza. It was an excellent plan. For about 90 seconds. A lot can happen in 90 seconds. I unbound just as many vampires as I did in Berlin, probably more, all their fine clothing ruined by the juicy sounds of their owners' elements being forcibly separated. Splorches and splashes and gushes ahead of me, even more behind me. So much blood on the steps, splashes of black and sometimes red in the white snow, if the vampire had fed recently. A few vampires got past Owen and Granuel and rounded the pillar on me, but I staked them and wondered how many Theophilus had brought with him. He was sacrificing a lot of soldiers to get to me. Did he have the guts to fight himself, I wondered. Had he emerged from the warded building, or was he still coldly issuing directions from the safety of his darkened room? The vampires figured out that Granuel and Owen were doing most of the damage, and they sent a few of their soldiers over the rooftops to land on Babington's and deal with them. Not that I saw that happening from down on the steps. I pieced that together later. The first I realized that something was wrong was when I heard Granuel cry out in surprise. I looked up at the Babington's rooftop and saw her twist in midair and just barely catch the tiled edge with her hands. She and Owen had been facing in my direction and leaning out the wide window of the pavilion to target the vampires coming my way, so they hadn't seen the ones sneaking up behind them, and Granuel got defenestrated. To keep from falling, she'd had to drop Scowaja, the only source of energy available to her. A vampire danced down the slope of the roof to finish her off, while Owen made the inexplicable decision to shapeshift into a bear to fight the remaining two in the room. He couldn't unbind any vampires that way, either by unbinding or by stake. I targeted the one coming after Granuaile and spoke two whole words of Old Irish before an unseen fist slammed into the side of my jaw, both breaking and dislocating it and causing me to bite off the tip of my tongue. It spun me around and I tried to face my attacker, but my balance was a mess, my ears were ringing, and the pain was occupying all my headspaces until I could get it shunted into a tidy, screaming box. The result was that I slipped on the icy steps and fell on my ass again. I let go of the bloodied stake in my left hand when a booted heel stomped down on my fingers and broke most of them. The stake got kicked away, and I blinked furiously and triggered my healing charm, trying to focus enough to have a chance at saving my life. A ball of dough sitting atop a pickle laughed at me, and I blinked again. Now it was a pale, bloodless face laughing at me, and the torso was dressed in a hunter green turtleneck underneath a long olive trench coat. Dark eyes and a douche lord's haircut up top, clean shaven, and a scar that began on his upper lip and continued underneath the bottom one. He cupped his right ear and mocked me.
I'm sorry. What was that? Theophilus? Yes. We meet at last, Mr. O'Sullivan. For a very brief time, at the end of your life. You were better than all the rest of the druids, at least. Congratulations on presenting a genuine challenge. Thought I should say farewell in person.
I scrambled back and up in a crab walk to put some distance between us. Pointless, really, when he could close it very quickly. I stole a glance at Granuaile. She was still hanging from the roof, and a vampire was trying to stomp on her hands to make her fall. It wasn't necessarily a fatal drop, 3 stories, but there was nothing save unforgiving stone waiting below. Theophilus followed my gaze and didn't like what he saw any more than I did.
Carl!
He shouted.
Hurry up and help Hans with the other one!
Carl turned his head to confirm that, yes, Hans was still having difficulty subduing Owen in the little rooftop pavilion. And that's when Granuaile lunged up, grabbed Carl's pant leg, and yanked mightily to pull him off his feet. He hit the edge of the tiles with his ass next to her handhold. She latched onto his torso, and then they were locked in a horrible embrace and fighting as they fell, tumbling so that when they disappeared behind the raised blocks of stone partitioning the steps, they were falling horizontally, the vampire's back to me and Granuaile almost invisible, except for the trailing flame of her hair. The crunch of their impact and their joint-choked cry of pain caused Theophilus to wince.
Ouch,
he said, and my inarticulate attempt at shouting Granuaile's name sounded as if I were trying to talk through duct tape. I reached behind my right shoulder and drew out Fragora, pointing it in the general direction of Theophilus. His eyes returned to me, and he snorted.
What do you think you're gonna accomplish with that? Steel won't do anything except make me hungry later for any blood you manage to spill with it now.
He was right. Steel wouldn't do anything significant to him unless I could manage to decapitate him. But Fragora was more than simple steel. It could cut through any armor, or make people tell the truth, or summon winds. Down the steps to the west, past the fountain and beyond the plaza, the narrow Via dei Condotti descended in a straight line to the Tiber River, which I'd be able to see on a clear day, but it was all dark and gloomy now. It was a long shot, but I had to try. Summoning wind didn't require a verbal command, just an effort of will and a source of energy. I pointed Fragora down the Via dei Condotti and gave it all the juice remaining in my bear charm, and a little bit of me as well. I groaned from the effort, drained, and fell back against the steps.
What the hell was that?
Theophilus said. I gave a little bit more of myself to target him and trigger my unbinding charm. He clutched his chest and said, So I hit him with it again. He took a step back, but that was all I had left. I listened to Owen bellow upstairs, out of my sight, heard people finally screaming about the blood-soaked snow, and realized that the hammers of God must have either suffered mightily and their cloak was no more, or at some point the carnage became too great to ignore under any spell. I heard nothing from Granuaile, and Theophilus, when he recovered, finally looked annoyed. If nothing else, I defeated his smug expression, and maybe I'd get a small result for my efforts after all. The dirty dishwater clouds in the west swirled and tore apart as Theophilus said,
"I think that's enough."
And a few weak rays of late afternoon sun pierced the snowfall and set his head to smoking as he lunged for me. He felt the burn and halted, turned, and shot away into the plaza behind the buildings where there was plenty of shade. His entire face sizzled and vented steam, and now he looked satisfactorily pissed. I heard a scream from up at the top of Babington's and saw a human form engulfed in flames, flailing in the pavilion. Owen's troublesome opponent had caught much more of the sun up there. Pointing at me, Theophilus turned his head to call over his shoulder.
"Marco, shoot him!"
The steel barrel of a rifle peeked out a window in the terracotta building, and I scrambled to hide myself behind the stone pillar. A bullet cracked off the steps and shattered some marble quarried hundreds of years ago. I was effectively pinned down now, unable to speak any more unbindings through my broken jaw, and my stake was nearby but in the line of sight of a sniper. I couldn't bind it to my palm without the ability to craft the binding. At least the sun had placed me in a no-vamp land. Any vampire who wanted to get to me would have to get through the sun first. I allowed myself a tiny sniff of hope. I'd figure something out in the next minute or so. A minute without someone in your face was all you needed sometimes. And then the lovely yellow patches of light on the steps faded as the storm clouds boiled back together in the absence of continued influence from Fragora. The literal dimming of my prospects gave me new and very serious doubts about whether any of us would survive this. I had a painful and debilitating injury, no juice left, and no way to get any more. I hadn't seen Granuaile get up from where she'd fallen, and as soon as the sun disappeared, more vampires leapt onto Babington's roof to bait Owen's great big bear. A stolen peek into the plaza allowed me a glimpse of the Hammers of God still battling the twisted Rosicrucians. There were fewer of them on both sides now, attrition taking its toll, but the vampires were leaving them alone, focusing on eliminating the druids instead. They were coming. Theophilus was coming. I wasn't going to get that minute to think. Maybe, instead, a quick observation. Theophilus had used only two methods of attack so far, and unless I was mistaken, he had rarely deviated from them his entire life. He either ambushed victims or sent overwhelming numbers at them. And I can't fault either strategy, because both are likely to lead to victory, and victory is what it's all about. Winning is the difference between old guys and dead guys. But when your opponent knows you'll try to ambush him, some of your advantage disappears. Theophilus had already sucker-punched me once, and if his sniper could get a clear shot, he'd take it. So his move would be to have his lads rush my position and flush me from cover. He wouldn't square off against me except as a last resort. I'd be willing to bet that he was a terrible fighter. Fast and strong and invulnerable to most attacks, but untrained. Which meant that Leif could probably take him, despite being younger and relatively weaker. Which meant that I could probably take him. If I had any access to Gaia's energy, that is. Drawing on old knowledge that these European vampires would never have bothered to acquire themselves, I set myself in a crouching stance behind the pillar, right foot forward, still sheltered from sniper fire. And then I began a series of forms with Fragora that I had learned in China. When combined at speed, they formed a whirling defensive guard about my head and torso. I didn't know from which direction the attack would come, so I had to give myself some chance of slowing them down, since they would be coming with a significant speed advantage. The first one came from behind the pillar on my right and led with his face, fangs bared. He expected to find a stationary target, not a steel blade whipping through the air that he wasn't breathing. Fragoras sliced through his head from top to bottom in front of his ears. His body's momentum carried into me and knocked me a bit to the left, and I was already thrusting in that direction, expecting another vampire to appear from there. The old one, too. And sure enough, one did. He ran right on to Fragoras' point, which missed his heart and punctured the lung he didn't need. Still, it hurt, and he stopped, though he hissed and hit me with his dead body breath. Feeling exposed, I twisted the blade and darted back behind the pillar, yanking Fragoras and the vampire with me. It was therefore his head instead of mine that got exploded by sniper fire from Marco. I recentered myself between the bodies and resumed my defensive forms. Neither vampire was completely toast, but they were down for now, until they could be unbound. In the meantime, I needed to be ready for the second wave. It would be any second now. I was sure I'd feel the impact before I saw anything coming. But no more undead minions materialized. I just got a good workout when I was already exhausted and in pain. Maybe that was the plan. Wait until I couldn't maintain my defenses and then swoop in. As soon as I considered it, though, I realized Theophilus didn't really have that luxury. When and if Owen dispatched the vampires that currently occupied him, he'd be able to unbind any that were left, provided he could talk. I was starting to think that perhaps he had shapeshifted because of a similar injury to mine. If his jaw had also been broken, a tactical move on the vampire's part, then bulking up as a bear and fighting it out would make sense for him. Maybe we had truly fought through most of the vampires. Or maybe there was some other skullduggery going on, time being taken to reevaluate strategy, given that I had demonstrated you can take out a vampire with a sword, albeit not permanently. A blur zipped past me to the left up the central flight of the steps, and then stilled well out of reach of my sword. It was Theophilus, face crispy and wizened and bereft of the smug confidence he displayed earlier. I kept my eye on him, but didn't stop moving Fragoras through my defensive forms. His appearance was most likely intended as a distraction, and I'd be hit from the sides or even up top. Flicking my eyes upward, I saw a dark shape descending from over the top of the pillar, and I pivoted to my right and hacked through it, splitting the body in two. But the gambit served its purpose. During that crucial second or so, Theophilus moved with blinding speed and bowled me over, tackling me to the cobbled plaza stones and trapping my sword arm against my body. As soon as we hit the ground on my left side, he reared back, grabbed Fragoras by the blade, and ripped it out of my hand, uncaring about the deep cuts he received as a result. He tossed it away onto the steps of the Keats Shelley house. I was unarmed, drained of energy, and unable to speak. He had me, and he knew it. He grinned, feeling confident again, and held me down with a grip stronger than any iron bands I've seen. Just to make that smile disappear again, I wanted to tell him Werner Drosche was dead, but I couldn't.
"Well done, sir. Well done," he cooed at me. "Not good enough, but definitely a fine challenge. A worthy opponent. When the world's nests hear that you killed so many, but failed to kill me, even with the sun, that will only add to my prestige. You've done me a favor, in a way, but that doesn't mean I won't ram my fist through your skull right now."
I didn't have the strength to break free. When he lifted his hand away, I wouldn't be able to block his blow in time. Or even if I did manage to get in the way, it would be an utterly feeble attempt. So I drained my own energy to trigger the unbinding charm on my necklace once more, having no other weapons at my disposal. I nearly blacked out at the drain, but he did let go of my left arm to clutch at his precious turtleneck. He hissed. And then, when the pain faded, he raised his fist high and said,
"Good night."
His eyes bulged, and he looked down at his right side, where a familiar stake had embedded itself underneath his arm. He dropped his fist to pull it out, but the unbinding had already begun, shredding him from the center out. The world's oldest vampire gave a wet, gurgling scream before he liquefied and splurted out through his fine clothing. The turtleneck didn't save me from an overdose of ghouls, but perhaps made it look like I had died too. I followed the path of where that stake must have come from, and saw Granuel standing off to the left, behind the pillar opposite mine, leaning heavily on her staff. Her clothes were covered in gore, and she was favoring her left side. But apart from either deep bruising or perhaps some small fractures, she was all right. She gave me a lopsided grin.
Hey, you look like I feel. Don't let me forget, we need to buy Lukta, like, all the beer for giving us those steaks.
I wanted to shout at her to be aware of the sniper, but I think she knew about him anyway, judging by the fact that she was already behind cover. I, however, wasn't. But the disadvantage to peering through one of those scopes is the very small field of vision. The sniper hadn't seen Granuel coming, and now he had taken his sights off me to search for who had just killed the boss. Or at least I surmised as much by the fact that I didn't immediately die of a bullet to the brain. Flailing for a second in ancient vampire goo, I sat up with an effort and crawled back behind the pillar. Owen wasn't finished making a ruckus. Babington's rooftop pavilion was on fire now, presumably ignited by the smoking corpses of the vampires caught in the brief rays of sunlight, and he used his brass-covered claws to burst through the wall as a bear and slide to the edge of the roof, where he shapeshifted to a red kite. I followed his progress as he arrowed across the piazza to a window in the terracotta building where Marco's rifle muzzle poked out. He didn't get there before Marco fired, but rather just as he fired, knocking the muzzle down with his talons so that the bullet went speff into Bernini's fountain. I don't know if Marco was aiming at Granuel or me. He didn't get a chance to shoot again after that. Owen disappeared into the building, and I presume he took out all the gun-wielding lads, one way or another, because he eventually emerged from the front entrance, dressed in one of their suits. In the meantime, authorities were pouring into the piazza, trying to re-establish order as a precursor to figuring out what had happened. The wail of sirens heralded the arrival of firemen and paramedics. Granuel and I had no difficulty pretending to be traumatized victims, and neither did the Rabbi Yosef Bialik. Only 5 of the Hammers of God survived, but they had defeated the Hermetic Kabbalists completely, and their beards looked like normal facial hair again. I noticed that all the silver knives had been removed from the body of the first Rosicrucian the Hammers had taken out. The rabbi floated the idea that maybe we should blame everything on the guys with the funny haircuts, and I nodded my approval.
I have lost good friends tonight, but this was a true triumph over evil, yes? We will talk later, when you can talk.
Yes, we would. I owed him some immortality, for sure. When Owen emerged from the building, he still had enough juice left in his brass knuckles to cast camouflage on the 3 of us and get us out of there. His jaw, I noticed, was misshapen, as I'd suspected. It was dislocated, for sure, and possibly broken like mine. We limped and grunted our way back to the grounds of the Villa Borghese and fell onto the grass once we felt Gaia's presence again. I numbed the pain first so I could keep my head clear, and set about getting my jaw back into place, and the bones and teeth bound together like old friends. Owen's jaw was merely dislocated, and once he popped it back into place with an audible crunch, a river of profanity that had been dammed up all during the fight spewed forth. Granuel likewise worked on her wounds, and once Owen wound down, we rested in silence and healed. After an hour, I could talk again, albeit with a thick slur.
Yay, team,
I said.
Damn, Owen said. I knew it wouldn't last forever, but it was right peaceful there for a while, not having to listen to your yapping.
Chapter 27. Fishing out my burner phone, I made a call and spoke past my bloodied lips and tongue.
Mia's now at the Antico Cafe Greco by the Piazza.
I thumbed off the call once I got an affirmative response.
Who is that?
Ronuel asked.
The answer to what happens next. Hungry?
Not while covered in blood. Maybe afterward.
I'm sure they'll have a washroom.
Charged up again, we camouflaged ourselves and walked back through the piazza, ignoring the barriers and surveying the damage. Babington suffered damage only to the rooftop pavilion. Someone got up there with a fire extinguisher and saved the building. There was nothing but oily stains and empty clothes to mark the final deaths of the vampires. Owen confirmed that we had gotten them all. He hadn't killed all the thralls, but left them broken, and in one case, naked. He'd lost his stake on top of Babington somewhere, and would have to look for it later. Mine had been found by the police on the steps, and was being bagged as evidence. As soon as the officer put it down, I snatched it up, unseen, and shoved it underneath my jacket. Normally, there would be something of a wait to get into Café Greco, the legendary establishment where Keats and Shelley and many other artists and poets dined over the centuries. Its red and gold interior with vaulted ceilings fairly teemed with the ghosts of creative minds, and people lined up to park their buttocks where famous buttocks had lounged in days of yore. But on a freezing, snowy evening in Rome, it was almost deserted. We kept the camouflage on when we entered and shambled past the maitre d' to the restrooms, where we could attempt to clean ourselves up somewhat. We could get our faces and hair clean, and Owen had stolen his clothing, so he was in good shape there. But my clothes weren't going to look decent again before they'd gone a few rounds with industrial-sized containers of bleach. Better to unbind them and let them feed the earth.
"You look like you killed a bus full of people, lad,"
Owen said.
"Yes, I do. But it'll be okay, I think."
We walked out together in camouflage, dropped it, then walked right back in again, entirely visible. Ronuel didn't look bad at all, having managed to either clean or conceal most of the blood on her. I was the one who had to talk my way in. I explained in broken Italian to the alarmed maitre d' that my clothes weren't stained with actual blood, it was corn syrup and food dye, thrown upon me by some damn animal rights activists who'd targeted me for my leather jacket. I gave him 50 euros, courtesy of the pickpockets I'd run into yesterday, and we were seated with alacrity at a table for four.
"Our friend will be joining us shortly," I explained.
We ordered espressos and sat in silence. We were exhausted, cut off from Gaia and quietly trying to manage our pain. There was little else to say until our guest showed up. When he did, Owen was the first to spot him.
"Feckin' hell," he said.
Then he began to speak the unbinding for vampires. I saw that a tall, pale Viking with straight blonde hair approached, dressed in a modern Italian suit.
"No, no,"
I said, clapping a hand over his mouth.
"That's who we're waiting for."
Leif Helgerson halted, because he'd heard what I said, and held up his hands to show that he was harmless. But Owen slapped my hand away and growled,
"Get off me, you poxy cock!"
"All right, just listen to him. He's gonna keep your girl safe."
"Fine, but give me a stick just in case,"
he said.
"He'd better feckin' behave."
I handed it over, and he laid it on the table in plain view as a warning.
"Atticus, what's going on?"
Granuel said.
"I thought you hated him."
"Not as much as I hate the thought of never-ending war."
I waved Leif over.
"Sometimes a deal with the devil is better than an eternity of righteous suffering."
"Good evening to you all," he said formally, pulling out his chair and seating himself.
"I am grateful for the invitation to join you. Congratulations on your victory against the druid's oldest enemy."
"Thank you,"
I said. Ronuel and Owen just stared at him in silence, their muscles tense and ready to lash out.
"I have the document you requested, Atticus," Leif said. "It is in my coat pocket."
His eyes latched on to Owen.
"I am going to remove it very slowly."
"Aye, ye take your feckin' time with that,"
Owen said. Leif's pale hand crept slowly toward his jacket pocket, and Owen's grip on the stake tightened. The hand disappeared. The faint rasp of fingers against paper could be heard, and then a single folded sheet emerged in his hand. He extended it to me.
"If you will, Atticus."
I took it from him and unfolded it, as Leif crossed his arms across his body, where Granuel and Owen could see them. They relaxed, infinitesimally.
"This is a treaty," I told them, "to be signed by the four of us, if you're willing."
"I'll donate me bollocks to charity first,"
Owen said.
"You're not required to sign it," I said. "Just listen."
Looking at the text, I became daunted. My jaw and tongue were in no shape to read this well.
"Granuel, would you mind?"
I offered the paper to her, and she snatched it from me without looking, keeping her eyes on Leif.
"You stay super fucking still," she told him. "As you command," he said.
Her eyes dropped to the contract and scanned it, while Owen remained on guard.
It says we're to help him eliminate competitors among the vampire leadership, she said.
"We will give addresses to the Hammers of God," I explained. "We don't have to do it ourselves."
"And you have already completed most of the work with your efforts to date,"
Leif added.
"I anticipate few, if any, obstacles at this point. I am, to the best of my knowledge, the oldest vampire in the world now."
Granuel continued.
"It says that from now on, vampires may not occupy any part of North America west of the Rocky Mountains."
"And?" I prompted.
"And Poland."
Granuel looked up at me.
"I do try to keep my promises."
Leif pointed out,
"The detailed language beneath says that vampires are to be given a month to evacuate those territories. After that, they may be unbound or staked on sight."
Owen growled,
"What do we have to give up for that?"
Granuel dropped her eyes back down to the paper.
"Everywhere else, we have a truce. Live and let be undead, I guess. We don't unbind vampires on sight, they don't attack us. The war is over. Each side is allowed to defend itself in the case of physical attack."
"Bah! That's right for abuse! Kill a lad and then say he attacked you and it was self-defense!"
Granuel nodded once to acknowledge that and kept reading.
"The vampires agree to maintain their population in the allowed territories in keeping with the Accords of Rome, which specifies one vampire per 100,000 humans.
She looked up at the ceiling, considering.
"If you subtract the population of just Poland and the West Coast, that means a significant net reduction of vampires worldwide."
"It's all shite," Owen said.
"Your grove will be safe, Owen," I said. "Even when they're bound someday."
He glares at me, but I know from experience that it means I've gotten through to him. If he isn't yelling at me, at least he's thinking about it. Granuel cocks her head to the side and points at the treaty.
"If I'm going to sign this, I want additional clauses."
"What does you have in mind?"
Leif asked.
"Vampires agree to immediately divest their significant financial holdings from fossil fuel investments. Any energy investments will be in renewable, sustainable sources."
"I see. What do we get in return?"
"The gigantic hint that fossil fuel investments are going to pay terrible dividends from now on."
She smiled at him.
"I guarantee it. Sell while the selling's good."
"Done," Leif said.
"And I want regular updates on the progress of Poland's evacuation until it's complete. Names of the vampires who leave and the cities they used to occupy."
She turned to me.
"I'm going to see the sisters often, Atticus, and they'll want to know."
"The contract already specifies that you will get a full report at the end of the one-month grace period,"
Leif replied.
"After 30 days, I will verify that every vampire has left Poland,
or else give you their location so that they may be unbound in accordance with this contract.
Ah, good enough. She set down the contract and drained her espresso. Well, I'm satisfied. I'll sign it.
Me too.
We both turned to Owen, who shifted his eyes between us.
You really think this shite is worth signing?
He asked.
I do. Join us, and with our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict.
I did not add that we would bring order to the galaxy, but Granuelle put her hand up to her mouth to cover a smile anyway. Owen missed it entirely. He said to Leif,
Add Ireland to the list of vampire-free zones, and I sign it. If there's any arse-kicking to be done in Ireland, I won't be doing it myself, not leave it to some dead lad.
Done.
Good,
Owen said.
Let's get this over with and start staying far away from each other.
Wait, one more thing,
Ronuel said.
A condition of my signature is that you have to finally answer this question, because I've been so curious. Do vampires poop?
Leif slumped in his chair and rolled his eyes at the ceiling.
Please, no. Leave me with some dignity.
You can be as dignified as you wish when you're leading the vampire world. We want to know.
He gave a dramatic sigh and covered his eyes with one hand while he spoke, so he didn't have to look at us. There was pain in his voice as he explained,
There is not really any excrement, per se, nor any contraction of the bowel. There is just this...
The fingers of one hand flailed about like lost moths, as if in search for the proper words, and then clenched upon finding them. He nearly wept.
Unseemly discharge.
Granuelle promptly threw her head back to laugh and fell backward in her chair. She rolled over and slapped the floor with her palm, carried away not so much by the content, but by Leif's evident disgust at speaking the truth aloud. Owen and I had a good chuckle out of it, too, and I was glad Granuelle had remembered to ask him. He would never have answered, except at that very moment. Leif produced a pen and wrote in the addendums to the contract while we tried to get control of ourselves. We all signed, and he countersigned, and then we schooled our expressions to look dignified, though for our parts it may have come across as three parts pain and two parts weariness.
Thank you all, he said, folding the contract.
His gaze turned to me, and he smirked.
We should not part without a few words from the bard. Now breathe we, lords. Good fortune bids us pause and smooth the frowns of war with peaceful looks.
Who said it?
King Edward IV in Henry VI, Part 3.
I spoke the next words slowly, making a special effort to enunciate clearly in spite of my injuries.
I will raise you a quote from Cymbeline. Laud we the gods, and let our crooked smokes climb to their nostrils from our blessed altars. Publish we this peace to all our subjects. Well spoken,
Leif said, his smirk widening to a broad smile. Waggling the contract, he said,
I will send you copies of this wherever you wish. For now, I have much to do. A publishing of the peace, as you said.
He rose slowly from his chair so as not to alarm Owen or Granuelle, and bowed.
Do keep in touch. Farewell.
Once he was out of sight, we all visibly relaxed. But we didn't say anything until we were sure he couldn't overhear us.
I closed my eyes and gave silent thanks to Briot, the Morrigan, and all the gods below for this moment of peace that was centuries in the making. Not that they had anything to do with it, apart from Briot's idea about the stakes. Sometimes you simply need to say thank you to someone, to be grateful for the road behind and the road ahead, and the place you're at.